It's Wednesday, July 1st. Today we're looking at the White House playing hardball with the USMCA, a Supreme Court ruling on birthright citizenship, and the reality of the AI-gated era. We've also got a look at why your favorite sports teams are turning into real estate projects, and the weird historical truth about how we build and destroy institutions. Look, let's start with the USMCA. The trade agreement that replaced NAFTA, it's coming up for a mandatory review before it expires in 2026. Instead of a quick, sleepy renewal, the current administration is using this as a leverage point to force Canada and Mexico back to the table. They're using the sunset clause, which is basically an expiration timer, to create enough uncertainty that the other two countries are effectively forced to renegotiate terms or risk the whole thing falling apart. Here's why it matters. The U.S. is pushing for things like higher domestic content requirements for cars and the dismantling of dairy protections. The White House is treating this like a zero-sum game, betting that our market size is enough to bully our neighbors into giving up ground. But there's a catch. If you force car companies to use more expensive U.S.-made parts, you're just raising the production costs for everyone. You end up with a North American auto industry that's less competitive on the global stage. It's a classic case of prioritizing a quick political win for a specific sector, while potentially kneecapping the entire supply chain. Honestly, it's a shitty way to run a regional partnership. By ignoring the rule-based systems we built to handle disputes, the U.S. is trading long-term stability for short-term muscle. If this turns into a cycle of retaliatory tariffs, we're looking at a lose-lose situation that's going to hit consumer prices and manufacturing efficiency hard. The administration is essentially betting that they can break the system to get a better deal. But they're ignoring the fact that the system was there to keep trade predictable in the first place. Moving on to the Supreme Court. The court ruled 6-3 in United States v. Wong Kim Ark precedent, upholding birthright citizenship for children of undocumented or temporary residents. The majority opinion written by the Chief Justice leaned on the 14th Amendment to reject the administration's attempt to challenge the standard via executive order. That said, the ruling is narrow. It does not address the broader expansion of executive power seen in recent terms, such as the court's recent decisions regarding civil service protections or campaign finance limits. Those shifts remain, effectively weakening federal oversight and deregulation efforts. The takeaway is that while the court acted as a guardrail on this specific constitutional question, it continues to provide a wide berth for executive action in other regulatory and administrative arenas. Now, on the tech front, the era of everybody gets the best model on launch day is changing. We are seeing a move toward more cautious release cycles, with labs increasingly engaging in pre-release safety testing. While there is no federal mandate for a 30-day oversight process, labs are increasingly coordinating with government agencies to review top-tier models for cybersecurity risks before they hit the market. This changes the way businesses have to think about their tech stack. If you're anchoring your entire workflow to one provider, you are one regulatory or safety-related delay away from an operational headache. The move toward model routing, building systems that can swap between different AI models on the fly, is no longer a nice-to-have for the tech-savvy. It is now a defensive survival tactic. Look, here's the thing. Enterprise clients are now stuck in a tiering system. Even the budget-tier models are hitting high-risk thresholds for cyber or chemical activity, which means companies can no longer just blindly deploy these things. You have to audit what you're using. Because using a high-cost, high-intelligence model for a simple task isn't just a waste of money anymore. It's a risk management failure. Meanwhile, the numbers behind the AI economy are shifting from speculative bubble to realized utility. The sector is generating significant annual revenue. According to recent industry analysis, the velocity of capital is increasing, though claims that the time to add $1 billion in cumulative revenue has dropped to less than 2 days remain anecdotal and should be viewed with skepticism. That massive infrastructure spend is having some weird ripple effects. For instance, the U.S. power sector is finally seeing growth after two decades of being flat. All because data centers are absolutely starving for electricity. And while people were worried that GPUs were going to depreciate into expensive paperweights, data shows these chips are generating returns for 8 to 9 years, well past their 6-year accounting lifespan. We're also seeing a clear divide in corporate performance. Companies in the top quartile of AI expenditure have seen 100% revenue growth over the last 3 years, compared to maybe 15% or 20% for companies that aren't spending on AI. That's a massive gap. It suggests that the integration isn't just hype, it's becoming a primary driver of how companies actually perform. On the development side, the labs are pivoting away from raw benchmark performance and toward embedding AI into the tools people use every day. Anthropic is putting Claude Tag into Slack, turning the platform from a chat app into a persistent, channel-aware coworker. Microsoft is doing the same with Excel, letting users codify complex financial logic into reusable AI skills. It's a shift from AI as a fancy chatbot to AI as an operational layer. Finally, we're moving into the age of the fleet operator. It's not just about automating a task anymore. With tools like Hermes and Composio, businesses are linking AI agents directly to their internal software, HubSpot, Stripe, email inboxes, and letting those agents run entire roles from start to finish. The strategy here is what they're calling the Obsidian Second Brain model. Instead of an agent constantly pinging an external API and waiting for an answer, you feed your company's internal communications and project updates into a local, static knowledge base. The agent lives there, it knows the context, and it moves way faster. What this means for the job market is pretty blunt. The role of the growth professional or the manager is changing. You aren't doing the manual work anymore. You're spending your time designing, debugging, and overseeing a team of autonomous digital employees. Or to put it another way, companies are finally finding a way to decouple their output from their headcount. It's a hell of a shift. And if you're still thinking about AI as just a browser tab you open when you're stuck on an email, you're already behind. Excellence is increasingly being framed as a byproduct of environmental design, rather than individual willpower. The focus is shifting toward building reliable routines that make desired behaviors automatic, under the premise that repeated actions eventually form your identity. By managing your morning, your social circle, and your time, you're essentially offloading the heavy lifting of decision-making to a system you've built yourself. Which honestly, sounds like a lot less work than trying to white-knuckle your way through a bad day. When it comes to talent, the latest outlook suggests we should stop looking for the right answer and start cultivating taste. The methodology here treats references as the primary source of truth, specifically looking at how people behave during past high-stress crises, like the 2008 financial collapse. It's an interesting pivot from the standard interview, moving from judging someone's current pitch to analyzing their track record under pressure. The goal is to move past mimicry and develop your own framework, rather than just reciting someone else's jargon. Finally, on the productivity front, the emphasis is on killing the priority ranking habit. The getting things done methodology suggests that instead of agonizing over what's most important, you should filter tasks by context, time, and available energy. If you aren't in the right place or don't have the right tools, the task simply isn't an option. It's a way to bypass decision fatigue entirely. The system argues that if you don't trust your list, your brain will stop using it, leading you right back to reactive, unplanned chaos. The common thread here is simple. Stop trying to manage your willpower and start managing your surroundings. If you don't design your environment, you're just leaving your day up to whoever screams the loudest. That shift toward infrastructure is hitting the sports world too. Look, there's a lot of noise in sports right now, but if you strip away the hype, it's mostly a story about capital, leverage, and the frantic race to 2028. First, the money. The Premier Lacrosse League just raised $100 million in a Series E round. They're ditching their old single-entity structure for a franchise model, which is a classic play to juice valuations by letting outside investors buy into individual teams. It's a smart move to get some runway before lacrosse hits the 2028 Summer Games. Meanwhile, in the NBA, the push for a Las Vegas expansion team is hitting institutional scale. We're talking franchise fees between $7 billion and $10 billion. You've got names like Bob Iger and Joshua Kushner circling the wagons, which tells you everything you need to know. Ownership stakes in these leagues aren't just sports teams anymore, they're massive, capital-intensive assets. It's not just about basketball, it's about cultural influence and media reach. If that deal goes through, it sets a new, absurd floor for what it costs to even get through the door of a major league. Then there's the MLS, which is still trying to figure out how to stop being a retirement home for aging stars and actually turn into a real television product. The Chicago Fire, for instance, are signing guys like Robert Lewandowski to build buzz while they wait for their new stadium to open in 2028. It's essentially real estate development disguised as a soccer strategy. The league is at a genuine turning point. If they can't use the current World Cup momentum to shift their roster rules and build a product that plays well on national TV, they risk getting buried by global leagues like the Premier League. And, man, the front offices aren't just spending on talent anymore. They're spending on data infrastructure. Teams like the LA Galaxy are realizing that hiring a few data nerds isn't enough. The real edge now is data engineering and UX design. It's about building pipelines that actually get information into the hands of decision makers, not just creating fancy models that nobody knows how to use. We're also seeing a massive, messy transition in player movement. The NBA's pre-agency era is in full swing. Teams are prioritizing salary cap flexibility over traditional free agency, treating contracts like trade assets rather than just paychecks. Historically, we saw this with the Raptors trading for Kawhi Leonard in 2018. Today, teams are managing their competitive windows by dumping aging stars before they become a drag on the books. Bottom line, the industry is moving toward high-moat, capital-heavy business models. If you aren't syncing your infrastructure, your talent, and your long-term events like that 2028 Olympics deadline, you're going to get steamrolled. It's not about the game anymore, it's about the balance sheet. That same pressure to consolidate is hitting the publishing world. There are reports that Warren Buffett has paused his annual mid-year donation to the Gates Foundation. While some speculate this follows a legal review into the foundation's historical ties to Jeffrey Epstein, these claims remain unverified and should be treated as speculative until official statements are released. It is a significant break in a long-standing philanthropic partnership, and it highlights how quickly an institution's reputation can become a liability that effectively turns off the money tap. Which, honestly, is the kind of accountability we don't see often enough in these circles. Moving to the media industry, NBC Universal is preparing for its eventual independence from Comcast by leaning into video game publishing. The strategy is to leverage existing intellectual property from their film and theme park divisions to mitigate the risks of developing new content from scratch. Meanwhile, the proposed Paramount-Skydance merger is hitting a wall in the UK. The British government is intervening based on public interest concerns, which for anyone following cross-border media deals, is a signal that these acquisitions aren't necessarily the slam dunks executives keep saying they are. Then there's the state of media itself, specifically the model championed by Joe Weisenthal at Bloomberg's Oddlots. The takeaway here is that even in a world obsessed with independent creators, there is still a massive value proposition for talent to stay within large, institutional umbrellas. By keeping his editorial freedom, Weisenthal has managed to build a brand that relies on a learning out loud method, essentially asking the smart, stupid questions that cut through professional jargon. The analysis suggests a few things about why this works. First, there is a clear high-value signal in nonpartisan technical conversations, especially when the rest of the media landscape is so saturated with grifters and performative, politically poisoned discourse. Second, it touches on a fascinating organizational hybrid. Bloomberg gets the benefits of a personal brand, and the creator gets the institutional resources without having to deal with the operational nightmare of running a solo business. It's a trade-off, sure. You lose total ownership of the IP, but you gain a level of stability that most independent creators, who are basically just small business owners with better mics, don't have. Wiesenthal's work also points to a broader reality about how businesses handle the 2025 tariff regime. The consensus view often assumes that external shocks will cause immediate collapse, but the reality is more mundane and arguably more depressing. Businesses are proving remarkably good at improvising, shifting logistics from China to India, absorbing costs, and pivoting on the fly. The catch is that this resilience comes at the price of long-term efficiency and planning. When you're constantly reacting to uncertainty, you stop building for the long haul. That mindset, the preference for granular reality over abstract theory, is exactly why the market is currently mispricing some of the biggest names in tech. According to research from D.A. Davidson, the market is overcorrecting on Microsoft. Even though Microsoft has an AI compute backlog 50% larger than its peers, the stock has been underperforming. It's a classic case of market sentiment drifting away from the actual boring reality of infrastructure sales. Speaking of the broader economy, the labor market remains stubbornly stable. We're looking at 7.594 million job openings, with hiring rates holding steady at 3.3%. It's not a surge, and it's not a collapse. For investors, this is the kind of data that makes the Fed's job a headache, because it gives them no immediate reason to shift monetary policy in either direction. Finally, we're seeing a wide-scale reassessment of the banking and finance sectors. Oppenheimer has downgraded major players like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and Citigroup. The reasoning is that we are hitting the maturity phase of the current economic cycle. Growth isn't dead, but the easy money is likely behind us, and analysts are bracing for a late-cycle environment where the economic headwinds are going to get much stiffer. Look, the common thread here is that we're in a period of transition. Whether it's Buffett pulling funding, regulators blocking legacy media deals, or analysts cooling on big banks, the market is trying to figure out which price points are grounded in fundamentals and which are just symptoms of a cycle that's finally starting to show its age. It's a good time to stop listening to the loudest voices and start looking at where the actual infrastructure is being built. If you aren't paying attention to the boring technical shifts, you're probably missing the only things that actually matter. Before I let you go, a few other things worth knowing this morning. First, astronomers have found that galaxies basically practice cosmic recycling. They expel gas, it cools down, and then it collapses back into the host galaxy to spark new stars. It's essentially a giant celestial respiratory system that keeps the lights on. If you're wondering how fast things can go off the rails when institutions fail, look at the Toronto Clown Riot of 1855. A brawl between local firefighters and circus performers spiraled into a massive riot, proving that when local power structures are corrupt, you don't need much of a spark to set the whole city on fire. On the corporate front, history shows that economic downturns are actually pretty good for cheap, sugary snacks. During the Great Depression, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups became a staple, affordable treat, a hell of a lesson in how to survive when everyone is broke. And finally, if you feel like you're getting more judgmental lately, it's not just you, it's the algorithm. Digital platforms are designed to manufacture outrage by pushing emotionally charged content, which triggers decision fatigue and basically trains your brain to pick a side before you've even had a chance to think. Which, honestly, is a shitty way to run a society. That's all for today. Keep your eyes on the infrastructure, not the noise, and I'll see you back here tomorrow.